Our first speaker is Richard J. Jackson, a professor and chair of environmental sciences at the School of Public Health at the University of California, Los Angeles. A pediatrician, he has served in many leadership positions in both environmental health and infectious diseases with the California Health Department, including the highest state health officer. For 9 years, he was the director of CDC's National Center for Environmental Health in Atlanta and received the Presidential Distinguished Service Award. In October 2011, he was elected to the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Science. Additionally, Dr. Jackson is the first physician member of the Board of Directors of the American Institute of Architects. And 3 months ago, he received their top award in architecture for non-architects for his contributions to the field. As a side note, Dr. Jackson is experiencing a first in his life at this meeting. This is his first time at a public health conference rooming with a fellow presenter, who is also his son. Dr. Jackson.
I love CSTE. I was the state epidemiologist in California. I'm an odd guy for both infectious disease, because I did that for several years, and as environmental health guy. But the last meeting I went to was in St. Louis, and Dennis Parada was on crutches back then, too. So it's he's not there now. But I always worry about Dennis, because he jumps out of planes for fun. After I left CDC in 2003, I pursued my interest in designing healthy communities, and here's two of my books, and ended up working on a PBS series, a four-hour PBS series on it. But I was very impressed as I listened to the sessions, and was most impressed by the young people in the room, and your technical skill, and the inspiration you gave me for the leadership that I want you to, and hope you will show. I have a couple big themes. You know that science matters, but the world you're going to be looking at over the next career, technology will change so fast. My first epi outbreak in Holland Patton, New York, we sorted sheets of paper on the motel room bed in order to figure out relative risks, and I'm not exaggerating. Ultimately, though, public health is about justice and how we treat each other and how we live. And to get some of the changes we need put in place in our society, we're going to have to be looking at deep culture changes, which I am very hopeful will happen. And ultimately, I want to say to the young people, leadership matters. And so we'll talk more about this. So I've been wondering, what happened to my country? I mean, who the hell stole it? Because it really has changed in a lot of ways that frightened me and upset me very much over the last 20 years. And I went back to my Catholic school education and figured out that, oh, it's the capital sins. And when I was taught the capital sins, I was, you know, it was Catholic school, so I thought lust was the most important capital sin. But I realize now in America that the mother and consort of all sin in this country, at least large portions of sin in our society, is greed. And we've taken greed from a personal sin to a societal characteristic, and we have endowed corporations that have the business of making money humanity. And yet they have humanity, but they don't die, they don't have to serve on juries, they don't have the obligations of being a citizen, even though we make them citizens, and they're expected to an extent to be amoral. So I think we need a moral shift. So I was lucky enough last fall, a year ago, to be offered a fellowship. It's the same one that George's Benjamin had at Roosevelt House on East 67th Street in Manhattan. And I got to spend 4 months there. And when I was growing up, there were two pictures on the wall. One was Jesus, and the other was FDR. And to be in that house, and I have another reason, which I'm going to show you, as to why I loved Franklin Roosevelt. You know, of all the memorials in Washington, D.C., we all love the Lincoln Memorial, but the FDR Memorial is really worth a visit because it's spectacular. He came in, and this country was prostrate. We were just on our back. The economy, 36% unemployment. we were really in terrible shape. And the statues at the FDR monument shows the fellow standing in the soup line waiting to get food. And the person that spent the most time telling FDR what was going on in the country was Eleanor. And when I was at the house, I realized it was called Roosevelt House, not FDR House, because Eleanor was clearly the partner in that presidency, and many of the big social changes came from her and came from the person she worked with closely on the cabinet. The head of the Department of Labor. Who had observed the shirtwaist fire. And she was the one behind Social Security. She was the one behind so many of the reforms we put in place in our society. And on the second floor of Roosevelt House, I would go in, and here was this room that had FDR's desk. It had a fireplace over here. It had his books, and it had a picture of his net. And it was all old white guys, with the exception of the Secretary of Labor, who so many of the changes were put in place thanks to the leadership of women. You know, very conservative forces didn't want a lot of the social programs that FDR put in place. And the country still wasn't that far out of depression, even though the Germans were bombing London. And on December 7th, the Japanese came across and they took basically the entire Pacific. They would have taken Hawaii very quickly on December 7th. It was 2,000 men died just on one of the ships that went down in Pearl Harbor. Wake Island, all the way down to the Philippines, the Burma, were lost to the Japanese. And this is a very important day. And I think we're at almost that same moment of thinking of needing a new strategy in the United States. The following day, FDR, of course, asked the Congress to declare war on Japan and pretty quickly on Germany. But the next day, he called in the leaders of Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, the airplane makers, and said, "You're not making trucks anymore. You're not making cars anymore. You're not making boats. You're making war material, and you're not going to do anything else until we are stood up and we have a stand. We're not going to get overrun and lose this war." Complete transformation of the United States government. The economy took off like a rocket ship. There were two major generals at that time, both of whom had deep experience domestically in the United States. Dwight Eisenhower was a colonel who broke up the marches, the VA marches on the Mall in Washington, D.C. following World War I. And George Marshall was one of his companions, the man behind the Marshall Plan. So what's he talking about? Why am I talking about this? Because it's so important. Well, something else happened on December 8th, 1941. This young man, Robert Jackson, volunteered to be in the United States Army Air Corps and went off and trained to be a fighter pilot, crashed once in the South and was hospitalized for a couple of weeks, but eventually was able to go back. And here he is flying over Iwo Jima, and he was flying escort missions over on the fighters over to Japan during that time. He came back from the war at age 24 or so, married his childhood sweetheart, and they had three babies in 3 years. This guy could do 100 push-ups at age 27. And one day, in August of 1949, he started to have trouble breathing. And he said to my mother, "You know, I'm having trouble breathing." And so they called the ambulance and took him to the hospital. And the next day he was dead of polio, leaving my mother with three babies basically in diapers. My New Jersey family came and picked up my mom. We all went back and basically spent the next several years living in poverty in Newark because we didn't have any money. This is the release from quarantine during that time. So my intrusion, my immersion into public health came very early, and boy, I knew public health was really important. I knew disease prevention was really important. But remember, we were all obsessed with FDR, and my grandmother went to work, Bob's mother, went to work for March of Dimes. And the picture here is of FDR with Basil O'Connor collecting dimes. And the other picture is the only picture that's ever been taken of FDR in a wheelchair. And it was the campaign, it was the grand strategy to eradicate polio that really stood things up. We had to do the science, but we actually also had to have the policy and the action to make that change actually happen. So after the war, these two men came back, and working with President Truman, we got the VI, the GI Bill, the VA housing, and other programs in place because they were desperately afraid that what happens after wars is a big depression recession. 19 million men take their uniforms off and are now looking for a place to work. And the solution to that was what I'm going to talk about for a couple minutes. The other thing they were worried about was they didn't want Germany and Europe getting into another war 20 years one more time. And they turned to George Marshall and handed him $30 billion and said, fix Europe. We don't want to go to another war. So this big investment into social and physical and infrastructure reform to make this change. I used to think of Eisenhower as being kind of a sleepy president, but boy, he sure looks good in retrospect for the things he did. He was, you know, we've all ridden on the interstate highways, and very few of us realize this was the Highway Defense Program. And oftentimes in the U.S., you know this with breast cancer and other things, the defense funding is actually what got this program put in place. There were two reasons for this. One was Eisenhower had seen the autobahns. He had seen how quickly you could move men and material. Even when there were bombs, you could fill them up and you could, highways really move things quickly during wartime. And they saw the atomic bombing, and they did not want people clustered too much in targets. So there was really an incentive to sprawl across America. There was another incentive, which was an economic engine for this country in a profound way. This is a picture of the California state flower, and they work really well. And we put them all the way across the United States, and people discovered, oh, boy, I can get a nice place to live and raise my kids, and the schools are pretty good, and I got a green lawn, and it's only 25 minutes outside of town, except that when everybody discovers that, it's an hour and 25 minutes outside of town. And so the engine of after World War II was cars, sprawl, building. 25% of the GDP after World War II was tied to cars, automobiles, fossil fuel, steel, and concrete. We turned the finest farmland in the United States into houses. Bucks County, north of Philadelphia, has 80 feet of topsoil, and they're building houses and car lots on top of it instead of growing food there, those of you who are interested in food. The picture here of that dwelling up there that has the we've built 3 million garages a year in the United States that we have to attach human beings to because it really is a metaphor for what we did in the United States. And we paved over 60,000 square miles of the United States. That's the equivalent area of the state of Georgia. Gets hot in the sun, doesn't turn CO2 into oxygen. We've actually invested in sprawling out over America. So who did we think about when we were doing all this building? Did we think about the needs of families? This is a slide my friend Howie Frumkin did. Imagine you lived in one of these two houses and you made friends with the person on the other side of the fence, 30 feet away, and you said, let's get together for a 4th of July party. So, yeah, let's get together and just throw the baby over the fence. I'll catch her and we'll have a picnic. No, I think I'd better drive. But I actually don't know how to get to your house. So I go to Google, and I figure out that I can drive for 17 minutes and 7 miles to get to my neighbor's house 30 feet away. Obviously, this is a joke, but where I'm going with this is the last thing we thought about as we built communities was the needs of people, the needs of our children, the needs of our elderly, the needs of the one-third of our population that doesn't drive. We thought about the return on investment. So I'm going to talk about money as I get towards the end. This marriage to automobiles means that we kill a lot of people. 30 to 40,000 people a year die of car crashes, and the leading cause of death for children in the United States is car crashes. I thought that when I was doing environmental health, we worked on 1 in a million cancer risks, right, Dennis? The 1 in a million death risk in the United States from driving is 76 miles. That's every time you do 76 miles is a 1 million death risk, not lifetime risk. The other thing is, this is Los Angeles, but planting things under concrete, ultimately it's dehumanizing the human experience. And at Los Angeles, but also in many major cities in the United States, every meeting starts with the following comment. I'm sorry I was late. There was a wreck on something or other. And I will ask every class I go to, I ask, what's the hardest part of your day? And I will tell you that 95% of the people in the room raise their hand and say, it's my commute. It's not my job, it's my commute. Boring slide, but where I'm going with this is it's a very important slide because it shows where the research dollars of the United States have been spent over the last 40 years. The yellow line is space. You know that all went up during the 60s. The green line is energy. Why did that take off in the early 1970s? Because everybody was in line trying to buy gasoline in the early 70s, and President Carter was a nuclear engineer, and so we did a lot of research into energy. When President Reagan came in, the energy research really went way down because there was a lot of influence from the fossil fuel industry that we had trillions of dollars worth of fossil fuel on the ground. We didn't want to change that too much. So what happened since 1980? This is a terrific paper and I'll give you these slides at the end. Between 1950, after World War II, and 1980, everybody's income in the United States, every quintile in the United States, went up almost 100% their income in real dollars. What's happened since 1980? We cut back tax rates. We lowered the tax rates to about 18% for capital gains. We did a whole bunch of things. And so the bottom four-fifths of the United States have been flatlined in income. The top 20% have gone up about 50%, the top 5% up 68%. But what does it look like after taxes? So we've had this massive shift of wealth to a much smaller portion of the population. Now, could this affect people's health, do you think? Well, General Motors, my old friend, I come back to them, did this bioassay. They did a focus group of college kids about 3 years ago, and they published it in the oldest college newspapers in the country. In the focus group, they said to college kids, what's your life like? Oh, I'm up to my ears in debt. My grades aren't that good. My parents aren't very smart. My life's awful. And the people on the other side of the one-way mirror got the message, oh, reality sucks. So the advertising always picks something that hits a raw nerve, and the advertising campaign was, reality sucks, but it doesn't have to. You can stop peddling, start driving, get a GMC Sierra for $35,000, and if you do, pretty girls will no longer smirk at you while you're not polluting, getting exercise, not adding to congestion. Well, I showed this in class, and the students were outraged. And they started tweeting General Motors, saying, you're bad. General Motors dropped the ad that night because it went around the country very quickly. But one of the young women in the class said, oh, Dr. J, you don't know anything. She's not smirking at him. She's flirting with him. She doesn't want to be with the flabby guy driving the car. And in a way, what I'm saying here is the millennials have watched the rat race lives their parents led, sitting in the cars long periods of time, worried about endlessly about money and keeping things going, and they don't want to duplicate that life. More than half the millennials want to live in communities that are walkable, bikeable, green, environmentally smart, and not to duplicate that lifestyle. So I went to CDC in 94, discovered it was 94 degrees that day and couldn't figure out why I left California, but it was a great job, and I still blame Henry for it, Henry Anderson. But we were up on Buford Highway, and I got a chance to drive on Buford Highway every day when I went to headquarters at CDC, and you've all been on roads like this, seven lanes wide, a suicide lane in the middle, and one day in about 1999, I'm driving to headquarters, and I'm rushing, it's hot out, and I see this elderly woman walking along the side of the road, and she's bent over with osteoporosis, and it's really hot. She has a plastic shopping bag, one in each hand. And she looks like my mother, and I want to stop and give her a ride. And I don't do it. I go to my meeting. And I called up my friend, and I thought to myself, you know, if she collapses, the cause of death will be heat stroke. And it won't be absence of public transportation. If she's killed by a truck going by, the cause of death will be motor vehicle trauma, and it won't be absence of sidewalks, absence of public transportation. So I called up my friend Howie Frumpkin, and I said, let's begin to write a book on how people live and where they live and their health. And Chris Katitsky, my colleague, we began to write an article. We actually wrote this article on the basis of no data whatsoever. We said, how we're building is probably killing people. And the National Association of Home Builders got 13 members of Congress to write to the head of, to Jeff Copeland and say, fire Dick Jackson. He doesn't know what he's talking about. And I was called in and said, Dick, where's your data? Well, Jeff, I don't need any data. It's obvious. If we tell people to walk and there's not a sidewalk within 2 miles of CDC, that's malpractice. We shouldn't be telling people to walk if there's nowhere to walk. Half the parks in Atlanta you can't get into unless you're in a car. Telling people to eat healthy food when it's twice as expensive as bad food and they're already squeezed for money doesn't make any sense. It's a setup for making people miserable. He said, Dick, you got to keep quiet until you get some data. So I, okay, all right. But he didn't fire me that time. So you know all these slides, but the big point I want to make here is the trajectory for the United States is going in the wrong direction. These are the obesity trajectory, 25 pounds more for every adult in the United States. The obesity epidemic is driving other things too, but the obesity epidemic is largely driving the diabetes epidemic. These are the curves for women and men for diabetes. And there's the map for diabetes in the United States. When I was a young pediatrician in San Francisco, I'd go to the diabetes clinic, the children's diabetes clinic. How many kids do you think I saw with type 2 diabetes? None. None. Now it's half the clinic, and their survival is worse than the insulin-dependent juvenile diabetes children because they've got all these concurrent illnesses at the same time. 2 out of every 7 volunteers for the U.S. military cannot get in because of lack of fitness and obesity and comorbid conditions. And we all know the best treatment for diabetes, either prodromally or beforehand or when you have it, is to exercise and be active. You've got to watch your diet too, of course. But you can reduce your risk substantially by walking. So you knew that part. You didn't know this one, probably. This is a comparison from N. Haynes of many things for people 20 years ago and a couple of years ago. People in the prime earning years of life, 46 to 64, no regular physical activity. 1988, only 17% of the population had no regular physical activity. It's now more than half of the adult population gets no physical activity. We've been wagging our fingers telling people to be active for the last 40 years, and we've been total failures. The trajectory is going in the wrong direction. You've seen lots of costs of medical care slides, but this is the one that always knocks the socks off me, which is here's the U.S. way off the charts with how much we spend per capita, about $9,000 per $8,500 per person in the United States, twice the average of the developed countries. And we're way below the lifespan of the countries that do spend considerably less than we do. And you know that. So while I was at CDC, and I became convinced that I would never, ever, ever give another talk without talking about climate change. No one in America should graduate high school without knowing what the Keeling curve is. Professor Keeling from San Diego measured CO2 on the top of a mountain in Hawaii, and this is what happened. When I was born, the planet's CO2 was 300 parts per million. It's now 400 parts per million. As CO2 goes up, temperature goes up, and here are real measures of temperature by real thermometers around the world for the last 150 years. Here's real temperature of the curve from the last 100 or so years. Here's the curve in my lifetime. And here's the curve in my son's lifetime. So we're looking at temperature increase, CO2 increase, and this is land. Ocean temperatures, they're going up as well. Here's the heat content of the ocean, real measurements with very low variance at this point, going up. Here's melting of the ice cap in first time in history in 2012. The top of the ice cap of Greenland turned completely to water. I was born in the mid-40s, so there were 11,000 square kilometers of ice at the top of the planet. It's now down to 6,000, and in the lifetime of my son, the millennial, it's gone from 7,000 to about 4,000 square kilometers during that period of time. Sea level goes up about 20 millimeters a decade, and it has for the last period of time. Here's carbon content of the ocean, but here's the one that blows my mind. And I've only seen this one recently. The upper curve is how much CO2 is dissolved in the ocean. It's been going up. Look how dramatically, just over the last 15 to 20 years. But who could think that the human activity could change the pH of the ocean? Because when you dissolve CO2 in water, you get a mild acid. So it's declined even over that period of time. These changes in our environment have caused the jet stream to move and have put us at much greater risks of fires. It's just heartbreaking to fly over the Sierra. There's not a bit of snow in May in the entire Sierra. This is the same day every year from a camera looking at Yosemite. So while I was in New York, I studied the impacts of Sandy and thinking about policy issues. How many of you know that Superstorm Sandy was the first hurricane in 700 years to move up towards the coast and not go out towards Europe and Greenland, but actually to turn left and go east all the way across? That's the change in the jet stream as well. The impact of Sandy, and their wonderful presentations, I won't steal your thunder, but it was very impressive to me as somebody who grew up living in New York many, many days of the year and seeing the Battery Tunnel filled with water, the tubes that I would take over to New York filled with water. One of them still not open yet. I did a 2-hour show at Tisch Studios at Lincoln Center on the psychological impacts of Superstorm Sandy on Channel 13. And people described how frightening it was to see the river pouring into the subway stations. This is down near the Battery. So even though people will tell you this is all being made up by a bunch of greedy scientists, I don't think so. Look at the Department of Defense and the Pentagon, who are paid to be realistic, and they say, we're worried about climate change and how it's going to do. This slide you have not seen, and it blew my mind when I saw it. Here's that left-wing radical International Monetary Fund, right? That is conservative, a bunch of business people and accountants and thinkers that you get. Fossil fuel subsidies, the burning of fossil fuels, and paying money to the companies that extract it from the earth costs globally $10 million a minute. The three and a third trillion dollars a year is greater than all the money on all the health spending in the United States. Remember, I'm sorry, not in the United States, in the world. 6% of the GDP of the world is now going to fossil fuel subsidies. And yeah, we want energy, but we ought to be thinking about subsidizing things that destroy the planet. Here's Jonathan Patz's wonderful cartogram showing things get fatter. The places get fat in his cartogram. They get fatter with the more CO2 they produce. Where do you think we're going to see the deaths from climate change? Let's make those countries smaller. And the countries where they have the biggest deaths will be Africa and the Southeast Asia. Imagine if the Himalayan ice pack will disappear. That means the Ganges and the Brahmaputra will disappear. With sea level rise and disappearance of the Ganges and the Brahmaputra, we're looking at 180 to 200 million refugees right there. And there's serious people that think there will be in the range of a half a billion casual deaths related to climate change in the 21st century caused by greed. So the head of the World Bank, climate change threatens our fragile existence on the planet and for public health. It's the defining issue of the 21st century, according to Margaret Chan. 2 minutes. Okay. back to greed. Down the street here, we have companies that tell us, don't worry about it. Here's a associate at Harvard getting $1.25 million to say, don't worry about it. And here is the Heartland Institute going to try and explain to Pope Francis that he shouldn't worry about climate change. So maybe a couple big takeaways, and I'm running out of time. One is, I think, personal opinion, I think it's a disgrace that NIH is spending less than 0.03% of its budget looking at something that cost $500 million, half a billion lives in the United States. Okay. And they spend more money on Behçet's disease than they do on climate. I think what we're doing doesn't meet the definition of child abuse, but it does meet the definition of child neglect. Inadequate supervision, exposure to dangerous environments. So I've now thoroughly depressed you, and I couldn't get to the part where I wanted to tell you how we're going to make it better, but here's how we're going to make it better. Just as FDR called in the leaders of this country and said, we have got to reinvent this country and what we build, we've got to think all the way from photovoltaic cells are now roughly at parity with energy production with fossil fuels. We've got to put in tax supports to make solar production of energy really go forward. Two is high-density cities really use far less energy. So compare the city, I know, compare the city of... where would you rather live, Barcelona or Atlanta? They both have 5.3 million people. And Barcelona has 17 times less the carbon footprint compared to Atlanta. So quality, density, green space, thinking about creating places that work for health, work for happiness, and work for well-being. So thank you for your leadership, and boy, do we need you now. Thank you.